21st, 1970. All right, today is November the 21st, 1979, and we are at the Castorville Public Library for the purpose of interviewing Mr. Russell Sowell for the library's oral history collection. We will be discussing Mr. Sowell's uncle, A.J., great-uncle, A.J. Sowell, and his great-great-grandfather, Tinsley, who was the Justice of the Peace here in Castorville. Okay, now we want to get some background first. But where were you born?
My name is Russell E. Sowell. I was born in San Antonio, Texas on August 5th, 1905. My father was Melvin Clifford Sowell, and my mother was Clara Lee Tice Sowell.
How do you spell that Tice?
That name is spelled T-I-C-E. Her people came from from Alsace, Lorraine, in the early 1800s. They migrated, came out of the way of New York, up through Tennessee, and down into Arkansas. And the family settled in Arkansas.
And from Alsace, Lorraine. They didn't come over with Castro, huh?
No, they didn't come over with Castro.
Oh, no, Todd. Okay, go ahead. And your dad?
My dad, Melvin Clifford, was born 4 miles south of Kingsbury on December the 1st, 1879. His father was Leroy Polk Sowell. And Leroy was the son of my great-great-grandfather, Asa Jarman Lee. My great-grandfather, Asa Jarman Lee, who at that time was living in Seguin, Texas, and raised a large family.
Okay, now, how many brothers and sisters did you have?
I have one brother, Raymond Clifford Sowell, who was born in 1907, recently retired here a while back as a locomotive engineer off the Missouri Pacific. Sister, an only sister, Ruth Cecile Sowell, who first married Colonel Daley Newland, and he has passed away, and she married a second time the Chief Warrant Officer, Arthur D. Johnson, and he also has passed away. But my sister is, at this date, is living at 918 Mason Street in San Antonio, Texas.
And that was, you had one brother then and one sister.
There
was the three of you.
It's a three.
Okay. And what did you do for a living? What was your occupation before you retired?
Well, I'd like to go back and give you...
You had plenty of occupations.
I had one occupation I enjoyed very much. When I graduated from high school in 1925, after posting 1 year, I went to work as a crew caller for the Southern Pacific Railroad. I held that job about 4 months, and then I took an examination and became a locomotive fireman on the Southern Pacific Railroad in 1926. In 1927, the Illinois Central Railroad needed firemen because they had a large crop of sugarcane, and they needed conductors and firemen and engineers to help them out. So they borrowed 16 firemen from the Southern Pacific, and I was one of the 16 firemen. I went down there with my buddy Matt Alder, and was down there 14 months. We did nothing but work things. When we arrived there, why, we had to, being oil burner firemen, we had to learn how to fire coal burners.
Now, when you say fireman, is that like, what is that, fireman, on a train?
On a train. In those days, you used oil and water to keep the steam up on that engine.
Uh-huh. And so what did you do? You just operated this piece of machinery then? Or?
Well, I was a locomotive fireman. I kept the boiler hot.
Keeping the steam in it,
and doing it by shoveling coal.
And putting the coal inside the...
Right.
Oh, the oven.
But in those days, we had what we called on those engines a semi-automatic stoker. which carried the coal from the burnt to from the back from the coal tender to the firebox. And we had to shovel a lot of coal because the coal come down out of that tank into a V shape, you see, and a lot of it hung on the sides.
We couldn't get it out.
Busy. And we went through a procedure there to where we had to fire, learn to fire these engines with coal, and we did that in the yards.
They taught you this before you?
Yes, before they sent us out on the road. They let us learn how to fire a switch engine. And Matt Alder and myself, we lived at the old Southland Hotel, which was on South Rampart Street in New Orleans. And
this is before you were married?
This was in 1927. And this was all before we went out on the road and we fired these engines, the switch engines. And the old Southland Hotel was directly in front of the Illinois Central Passenger Depot on South Rampart Street. And all the trains came in through that particular depot, passenger depot, freight and all, you see, come right in there because the yards was all in back of it, backed up to the Mississippi River. And I had a little engineer, a little French engineer by the name of Frank Bavoux, B-A-V-O-U-E-X, that I spent most of my firing time with him. We would take about 40 flat cars out at one time, and we had spurs all up and down those sugarcane brakes.
And what's a spur?
A spur is when you leave the main track and go through the side track.
Oh, I see. Okay.
And a spur is a track from the side track into the down through the cane field, which sometimes would be 2 or 3 miles. And these old darkies would cut this cane with big knives and tie it in bundles and walk up to the flat cars and throw it on the flat cars. And we would move with them whenever they had to where they was working next. And when we finished at the end of the day, we pulled all those flat cars back to the side track and left them there, and the first two freight coming west would pick them up and take them on into Sugar Land, Texas. And I did, I was down there 14 months altogether. I came back to San Antonio. I held a regular job.
Well, did they send you to these places, or did you request to go, or?
Oh, we volunteered.
You volunteered?
Yes, we volunteered. There wasn't many men.
So they weren't paid, you didn't get paid for it?
Oh, sure.
Oh, but they just, anybody wanted to go, volunteer to take this job?
Yes, but there wasn't very many of those old-timers down there that was willing to go to New Orleans and learn and shovel coal as a farmer. They were too, they were too, too happy
way,
to set, well, they were very happy to set up there and just burn that oil instead of shovel coal.
Coal, that was a lot easier.
But I will never regret it. I think that was one of the greatest highlights of my life. Because our division points were on the Illinois Central was from New Orleans to Jackson, Mississippi, and from Jackson into Memphis, Tennessee, and I've been over every inch of that road. But my greatest thrill is when I found out when we went around the curve at Vaughan, Mississippi, that I was firing an engine around the same curve that Casey Jones was killed on. And I wouldn't take I wouldn't take anything.
Well, do you mind? What was the salary back then for such a job? I know everybody talks about 75 cents an hour they would get for this, or
no,
the month. Or?
I was drawing $5.25 a day.
That was good
eight,
money then.
For 8 hours work. Now we were working 15 hours and 50 minutes, and I was drawing that much. The additional in overtime, which was time and a half.
Oh.
So I was making, let's say, practically around $15 a day. But the thing about it is that we had to sleep on the train that we had. We had a caboose where we all bunked in. We cooked our meals on the top of this boiler on the engine. We didn't have any fancy restaurants to go to. At times we were stuck between towns we couldn't even get to. we had to buy slabs of bacon about 2 foot long, and we bought beans by the sack and potatoes by the sack and onions by the sack, and we
just left them there
that.
And cooked as you want.
Yes, and I made a lot of cornbread with just water.
And what did you bake it in?
On top of the boiling wood on the engine. I had no bacon powder.
We
just wet that cornmeal.
Well, and what did you do? That water, and that was it. You just drank water then? You didn't have like juice and milk or beer or?
No, we drank all of our coffee black. We didn't have time to fool around with milk. There's no way to keep it at all.
No,
we
that's right.
Tried,
no refrigeration.
We even tried this Carnation milk, but it spoiled. Because we didn't actually need sugar in milk.
No, that's true.
The beauty part about it is that if you wanted to roast, you had no trouble at cooking. Just take it and throw it up on top of the boiler and watch it and keep churning it, and it baked real good.
And you had your dishes and cups and pots and everything. It's just like a little apartment. This
No. We had very few of those. We all had a knife and a fork and a tin plate, and that's all, and a tin cup. That was our dishes. And we had them, we cleaned our own dishes, and we kept them in our own place, and we had on bunks. I got to remember that there's an engineer and a fireman. There was a head brakeman and a rear brakeman and the conductor. So there was 5 men living in this caboose. Now, this is summertime, so instead of sleeping inside where it was pretty hot, we got out and slept on the grass on the slant of the terrain.
And just not afraid of animals or anything?
Well,
it was cooler, that's all that mattered.
There was no danger around there at all. The only time that I ever got hurt or anything like that, was I walked into a sugar cane patch, and that sugar cane, you know, those leaves on there cut you like a razor.
And you got all.
I was throwing my arms back and forth like that, and one of them come right down across here, and it just like
slit your arm open.
But that.
Well, no doctor on this thing either, huh? If you got sick, you were just
on your
own?
No, but we could have a doctor there.
If you needed one.
We could get one out of San Antonio today because we had equipment there, the hooks we called them, that had a telephone on one end, and we threw it over the 2 wires, and that gave us a connection to any place we wanted to talk to between New Orleans and Jackson, Mississippi. So we were never in
any pickle, really, then.
No, and besides that, a doctor would come by every so often and ask us how we felt and all that while we was out there. And then we had a watch inspector that would come out of New Orleans to check our watches to see if they were all right or
all on time.
Doing it on time and all of that.
Was this mostly passenger or and freight or all freight?
We were on what they call a work train. We handled no other things.
No passengers then.
No passengers and no other freight. We just went from one place to the other, one town to the other, where they had a sugar cane crop to be harvested. It was 5 months from the time I left New Orleans until I got back the second time. And then that was only for 2 days while they made while they put new piston rings in the pistons on the engine we were using. And that's the only thing then that got it. And I owed 5 months rent at the hotel, and I hadn't paid
them. You haven't been there, probably.
But I hadn't even drew a check. The paymaster had come by. I'll have your pay ready, but here's $100 a piece for you. They'll tide you over, pay us off that. When you get back in, I'll come by the auditor's office, and the check will be brought up to date. There was no way for them actually keep track of our salary any other way than what they did, and we didn't mind. We wasn't going into
place anyway.
There was no radio, no TV, anything.
What
like
did
that.
You do for entertainment? Just nothing. Did y'all play cards or anything in the tournament?
Oh, no, we just
dominoes.
Look, when you work 15 hours, there was a law that said that you could not work a man over 16 hours. They could work you right up to 16 hours, then mm-hmm. they had to give you 9 hours rest. You see, that was a federal law.
Uh-huh.
So the railroad worked us 15 hours and 50 minutes, 10 minutes under that, and then they could call us on 8 hours rest,
uh-huh.
you see, which was all right with us.
Uh-huh.
Now, in the meantime, I was doing what you call engine watching. I was watching the engine 4 hours. Out of the 8 hours that I was off duty. Now, an engine watchman.
From your fire burner phone?
Yes.
Okay, what does the watchman do?
I was watching that engine. I had to keep the coal hot and I had to keep the steam up on it. You see. So you're going to ask me, I was getting paid for that $4 separate. No overtime on it. That was just another job.
You're a regular workhorse, huh?
Well, I was the only one that could do it outside mm-hmm. the engineer, and he split the other 4 hours with me, you see.
That kind of gave him a let up then.
Oh, sure. So we got all the rest we needed.
Mm-hmm.
We were ready to go back to work. As a matter of fact, I felt kind of sad the day when they said, okay, you boys had it. Now, Matt Alder and I were the last two men to come back.
Well, what closed it up, or what happened that they?
Well, they run out of sugar cane to cut and haul.
Oh, I see. So then you came back to San Antonio then?
Yes, and I married my wife on January, I married Helen Louise Hoy on January the 26th, 1930.
And that was right after, this wasn't, what years was that when you were working for the railroad then? You tell me what years.
Well, 19... I went to work 26.
26. So you were there, what, 1 year about?
Well,
in New Orleans and...
Yes.
Yeah.
I went to New Orleans. Yeah. I got more experience there, and then I come back. I got cut off in 1930, right after we were married. No, 31, right after we were married.
You came back and worked in San Antonio for
a while. Oh, well, I still have held my seniority on the Southern Pacific,
I
you
see.
We were
I
just
see.
Loaned to them, you see.
Oh, so you had a job when you came back
yes,
here
I
then.
Yes, I came back to a job, yes.
Mm-hmm.
And we were the last two to come back. Man, I'm telling you, we had fun coming back.
About the diesel, when did that, you were talking about steam and coal, when did the diesel then?
I don't know.
Many years that
oh,
was?
The first diesel, I believe, came to San Antonio, and I'm not sure of this, but it must have been about 1929 or 30.
Something around there.
Is when the first. You see, during my journey as a fireman on the SDY, I worked out of Houston on the extra board, and also Victoria extra board, Yoakum extra board, Alice, and I was on a switch engine or every job that Eagle has for 7 months during my tour. As an extra fireman, they can do anything with you but drown you. And when they send you the Eagle Pass switch engine, well, you're drowned.
You're drowned, huh? Well, did you always work for the railroad then?
I got cut off of the SD. I got cut off the SD in the latter part of 1931. That's when the panic really hit. I came in off a regular job that I had then, that on what they call the Dallas Division, or Dalsy. I had an engineer by the name of Bill Rowland, William Rowland. When I got in, I was 26 times out on the extra force. I went from a regular job to 26 times out on the extra force. So I asked them to cut the board and cut me off. So they cut 19 men off of that, 19 of the youngest men off of that extra board. Told them you're through. We'll call you back whenever we need you. Well, at that time, my wife, Helen Hoy, was working at Southwest Forty Supplies. And so I took it easy, not because I wanted to there for about 3 or 4 months. And then I got a job with Coglaze and Hoff Construction Company, hauling a hot asphalt base. They were paving a lot of streets around San Antonio. I worked for them for quite some time. And then after that, why I went back to school and took a course in carpentry from a man by the name of Vincent Pinney. And he got me a job with Petrie Sauer Lumber Company. And I worked as a carpenter's helper for a while. But I managed to keep busy. And then one evening, I walked in. Saturday afternoon it was. I went down to get my wife. And she was working Southwest Photo Supplies on the corner of Blum and Bonham, right in the rear of Dusty's. And Mr. George Miller asked me what I was doing, and I told him nothing much. And he said, "Have you worked this week?" And I said, "I worked 3 days." And he said, "How would you like a regular job?" I said, "Oh, I'd like a regular job pretty good." And he said, "Well, we'd like to hire you." And I looked at it kind of funny and said, "Mr. Miller, for the love of Mike, I don't know anything about making pictures." He says, "You won't be making pictures. You're the type of man we want." He said, "We want somebody that don't know anything about pictures. We want to paint them our way, not their way." And I said, "Well, if that's what you're looking for, I'm the dummy. Because I don't know anything about making pictures, and I guess you know what I've been doing for the last from the time I got out of high school till now, is obeying orders given by other people, such as train orders, and the engineer's been my boss, and I think under those circumstances that I could answer
qualify for your job
because I'm used to taking orders." And, I'll be learning something altogether new, and it would be interesting to me. And he says, "All right, can you go to work Monday morning?" I said, "Well, this is Saturday afternoon." I said, "I think that would be the closest time I could come down." I said, "What time you open up?" He says, "Helen will tell you." She was working there. But this came as a surprise to her that he wanted me. Yeah, she didn't know a thing in the world about it. And it just so happened that one of the boys that was working there quit that company. And when I walked in, why, they hadn't thought about anybody else. They had nobody else in mind. They said, "Say, come here, I want to talk to you." So I went to work there, and then when I was 65 years old, I retired there, and I retired. I was going on 9 3/4 years.
Oh.
But while my job there, I started out as a packer and a delivery boy and anything else the boss said do.
You did.
And we washed, the boss and I even, we washed down the sidewalks and we dusted and we did that. My boss was a wonderful man. And he would never ask anybody to do anything he wasn't doing himself. And I didn't know that until I went to work for him.
Mm-hmm. And did your wife stay working there,
too? My wife stayed there and worked up until the time we had a only, first and only child, a daughter. And then she was out there, worked part-time even then, you see. Mm-hmm. And actually, I figured that I've only been married, although we'll celebrate our 50th wedding anniversary next November, that I've only been married half that time, 25 years, mm-hmm. because I spent better than that on the road as a traveling servant.
Oh, I see.
And in those days, I'd be gone as well, no less than 3 weeks
at a time,
and at times I would be gone 5 to 7 weeks if they had a convention going on someplace
uh-huh.
that I had to attend.
That you had to stay long.
Yes, that I had to attend for a week.
Well, it sounds like you had a pretty exciting group of occupations there.
When I retired from Southwest Florida, I retired as assistant manager, one of the stockholders. Still have stock up there. It's good stock.
Uh-huh.
It's helped me financially very much.
Made for a nice retirement.
Yes, it did.
And now you can really and your wife is retired, I presume.
Yes.
So y'all are spending together now.
Yes. I had a hard time with her getting her to retire though. Took me about 3 or 4 days to get her to sleep at 8:30, 9 o'clock.
Is that all? That's pretty good, 3 or 4 days.
Yeah. Wait,
Okay, Mr. Sal, let's go on to now. Let's discuss A.J. Sal, who was your great uncle, your dad's uncle.
My dad's uncle.
He was your dad's uncle.
Yes.
And, of course, he is the author of one of the books that we have here at the library that's pretty famous for the early settlers and the stories around here. Let's see. A.J. was born. Do you have any idea what year?
Oh, A.J., he was born August the 2nd, 1848.
No, exactly.
On Walnut Creek in Seguin, Texas.
In Seguin.
Later on, his daddy, after moved in the northeast part of Seguin on Mill Creek, and but Adeline was the oldest child, a daughter.
Of his, or is this his sister?
Of A.J.L. Adeline was his sister.
I see.
And he was the second child. Adeline was the first child.
He was the second. And his parents were?
His parents were Asa Drummond Lee and Mary Mildred Turner. Turner's sister married Leroy Polk, my grandfather.
I see how that goes. And Polk and him were brothers.
Were brothers, yes.
I see. And you said when you were younger, you actually knew A.J.
Well, I was 7 years old when I first realized who A.J. Sal was. But he had been to our home before that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, kids can be 5 or 6 years old, but they don't know exactly who that man is until he gets to
grow. Uh-huh.
In other words, you don't recognize him as such. But when I was 7 years old, and this was in 1912, I'm going to call my great uncle Uncle Jack for short.
That is what you called him.
Uncle Jack was writing Frontier Days of Texas for the San Antonio Light. He was doing most of that. He was doing all of that writing at our house. And I don't know how many editions that he wrote for the Life, but he was at our house during that period for about 3 years, from 1912 1915. But not all that time was he writing for the Life, but he wrote quite a few articles. And
that was his occupation.
He was a writer. And I remember him, I would walk, I think it was on a Thursday or a Friday. But anyhow, these articles was published in the weekly in the Light on a Sunday. And we would walk from our house, which was up on Government Hill, down through the San Antonio Light office, The light office in those days was between, was on Travis Street between Alamo and River Avenue, now Broadway. And he would turn his work into a man by the name of Mr. Beach. Now, I don't know whether he was the owner or the editor or what his official job was, but he would always sit down and talk to Uncle Jack, and he'd reach into a drawer there and pull out some bills and count out some money to Uncle Jack and pay each week. And then we would have him walk down there. I got a big thrill out of riding back with him on the streetcar.
I didn't know streetcars were in San Antonio. Well, how old of a man was he then?
Well, he was born in 48, and this was 1912.
They ain't 50, about 60 then, huh? About 60. And he was living with you, with your family?
He was living with our family. Each time he would come, and he did that, he lived for a long period of time with our family.
Mm-hmm.
And each time he'd come, we didn't know he was coming, anything like that. He just came up there with his suitcase, walk in and say, if Papa was there, he'd say, Cliff, I've come to spend this day.
And Cliff was his nephew, huh?
Yeah. And he would say, okay, Uncle Jack, you know where your room is. And if my daddy at that time was a brakeman on the Southern Pacific Railroad, and if he was out on his job, he would walk in and say, Clara, I have come to spend this day.
And where did he stay when he wasn't staying with y'all?
Well,
around, huh?
He was out gathering information on Tom, Dick, and Harry. Most of the time, his daughter Adeline had married a man by the name of Truman Hill and lived in Centerpoint, Texas. And she had seven children altogether. The first child was a boy, and it died at a very early age. But from then on out, she had six daughters.
And who was this?
His daughter.
His daughter.
His daughter, Adeline.
I see. Okay.
She married Truman Hill.
Yeah.
In Uvalde, Texas, 1899, I believe it was. And having all of these six girls, why, there wasn't much room in there for Uncle Jack and that family. Because houses in those days, the majority of them were rather small.
Four rooms, period, yeah.
And so Truman Hill built him a nice old house in the rear, on the back side of the house, in the rear of the house.
Uh-huh. And that was in Uvalde?
No, that was in Centerpoint.
That was in Centerpoint.
But that was just a stopping off place for it for a while, because besides living with us, he would go up to Post, Texas, in Garza County, on the Spur Ranch, and live with his sister Isabel while he was riding up through there.
And he was collecting stories while he was traveling around.
Getting all that information. And then, from there, he would go visit his brother, Fleeman Smith Sal, who was in the insurance business and a judge in Jones County at Stanford, Texas. He would go up there and visit his brother. He spent very little time in Centerpoint. But before his daughter married Truman Hill, A.J. was living on Verde Creek. I think that's the name of it, Verde Creek in near Centerpoint. Very close to the place where the government has his camels up there.
Oh.
He lived about less than two blocks distance from the camels, over there, and he knew every one of those soldiers by their first name and the commanding officers and all of that, and would go out on scouting expeditions and testing those camels and things like that. And but then later on, when his daughter married Truman Hill in Uvalde, he moved to Center Point.
And his wife had died earlier?
A.J. Sowell was one of the, and I'm not saying it because he was not a great uncle, but he was one of the kindest men that you ever saw. He was kind to everybody. He was always helping somebody out of trouble. Or by that I mean financial trouble or sickness or something like that. I don't mean helping them out law-wise. But when he published that book, he gave my daddy and my uncle and everyone of his people a copy of that book. He sold them for $5 and he never revised. He never had a cent. And when he died, died in San Antonio on July 4th, 1921. His daughter Addie would call my daddy and told us. My daddy got me and he headed down there and we had to cross the street. We had to break through the 4th of July parade that was going through the past the Santa Rosa Hospital at that time. And he had had a stroke. He had come home from his brother, who lived, Brother Clement, who lived then, and he'd come home from his sister Isabel, that had lived in, was living in Post, Texas. And he was in there writing in his little house, in back of Truman's house, his daughter's house, and he had a stroke. And his daughter Addie said, well, told his husband, I'm going out and see what Jack's doing out there. That lamp is getting awful low. He must be running out of it. And she went out there and she found him all slumped over and thought he was asleep. And she turned him over and noticed his face was all blue. He had had a stroke, so they rushed him to Santa Rosa Hospital. Well, he died a few days later from pneumonia. That was the part of his
life. Not from the stroke, that's
right.
Kind of all went together.
But you take the life of, in 1916, I was with my daddy and mother, and he visited Uncle Jack. When he was in Valentine, Texas, he was out there writing up stories on all those rich ranches out there, and he was living in Valentine. And my daddy took a picture of him standing outside his little adobe house there with a hand behind his pose like that. It's in the book there.
I've seen that picture.
And my daddy took that with a 130 size Eastman Brownie camera, box camera. That's how that picture was made. The majority of the other pictures in those books were made either by Gustavus and her poems in the 1900s.
Well, why did he start writing this book? Was it because of his job at the light, or was it an interest he had in it?
No, I was afraid you weren't going to ask me that, but I want to tell you the truth about that now. This is the actual truth. This is what happened. When you're in the Rangers, you're lonesome. You're looking at the same man all the time.
And he was a Texas Ranger.
And he was a Texas Ranger. Although the light paper and the frontier times and all that stuff made him a captain, he was never a captain in the Rangers. He was went in as a private and came out the same way.
Same way.
But a lot of people called him Captain Sal. I think that was more or less a
homage.
But anyhow, you get lonesome. And while One of the general rangers, he was shot 4 times. And as a youth, I have seen all of his wounds. He survived every one of them. Some of them were bullets in the arms and the arrows in the shoulders and stuff like that. But he never did brag on himself. He gives very little history of what he done. He was a writer, and if he was going to write something, he wrote it about that subject only and kept his own self out of the business.
Out of the picture.
Which every writer should do. I learned that from him. If you're going to write about that and forget everything else. Well, to go back, the first thing that he ever wrote, and I have the original manuscript has never been published. And he wrote that, and it is the only thing that he ever wrote about himself, personally. I know where the original manuscript is and who has it, but I have a copy of it. And he titled it Departing. In that article, he tells about him joining the Rangers against the, he was joining the Rangers, and how and where and when and all of that stuff. How he told his dad, how he told his mother, and all of that. That's the only thing he ever wrote about it. So I have a copy of that. And then, when he joined the Rangers, he began to take notes. And he had so many notes, I don't know when they ever fought.
He was really writing all the time.
Yeah, he wrote everything. And then when he came home, and this was in 1872, and his father, A.C. Jarman Lee, when Gonzales was created, formed in 1848, his father became the first district clerk of Guadalupe County. And his brother, Andrew Jackson, was the original stockholder in the county. Well, they all bought shares in that county.
Oh, to build it up.
And, the brother of A.C. Jarman Lee, Andrew Jackson, was a courier for Travis from the Alamo.
Well, that's a bunch of famous guys there, huh?
Well, the reason that Andrew Jackson was a courier for Travis from the Alamo is the fact that he knew that particular country. He knew the sharp cuts, everybody lived in it, and where everything was. And Travis, outside of being a ladies' man, he was smart enough to know, all right, I need a man that knows that part. So he had about 12 couriers, and each one of them had a place there that where they went. So, now this stuff that was passed on to me by my great uncle, this is nothing that I could have ever made up.
But that was the reason.
The name Andrew Sow is, his name is on the plaque in Alamo. I think of being a courier for that. He was a brother to A.C. Jarman Lee, the father of Uncle Jackson. Andrew Jackson was an uncle to Andrew Jackson. Andrew Jackson, number one, had a brother, Asa Jarman Lee. Asa Jarman Lee named his first child Andrew Jackson after his uncle.
I see. Now, it's kind of complicated.
When Andrew Jackson named his first son Asa Jarman Lee Jr. You can't tell me that there wasn't some kind of
family affair going on there.
Affair there.
Well, now back to this. Why did he write this book? You were saying he was lonesome in the Texas Rangers.
Well,
he was writing while
he made all of these notes, and in his copy of Rangers and Pioneers in Texas, he devotes one half of that book to men in the Rangers at that time.